You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
I'm delighted to have my next guest. He's actually been on RCR before, discussing his research. It's Dr. James Kerstead. He's a senior research fellow at the New Zealand Initiative. He's written a number of reports, but the most recent one is around academic freedom, and it's titled Unpopular Opinions, Academic Freedom in New Zealand. And James, firstly, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're quite a talented man. I mean, not just from the writings that you've done, and that I was just saying to you before we came on air, when it comes to free speech, communist China, bloating and administration, they all sort of tick my boxes. But I was looking at your background. You got a BA from Oxford, an MA from the Uni of London, and just to sort of, you know, finish the triumvirate of sort, you've got a PhD from Stanford.
I do, that's right. Yep.
Impressive. And then the classics, no less. Well, that was your BA.
Yeah, no, I have BA and PhD in classics, and I actually got two MAs, one in ancient history and one in political science. So while I was doing my classics PhD at Stanford, I was taking a lot of courses on democracy because I was interested in ancient Greek democracy. And then at a certain point, I figured out that I actually had so many credits that I could just do a few more courses and I can get a completely separate PhD in, MA. So that would have been ambitious. Completely separate MA in political science. So, that was great. That was a very interesting experience. And I was exposed to sort of very different intellectual culture than the one I'd been exposed to in classics. You know, the political science department at Stanford was very numerate, very quantitative, and I hadn't really been exposed to that kind of, you know, game theoretical modeling and statistics and things like that before. And I'm still not an expert at all in those things, but it really kind of got me interested in that way of looking at the world.
Says me to you, actually, the American model is very strictly political science. As you say, numerate, quantitative, statistics driven, where it says me to you in the more New Zealand, and perhaps it was the same in the UK, political studies is much more qualitative and broad and conceptual. I was going to ask somewhat mischievously, for a man who studied classics and yet are commentating so much in the modern world, how would you explain that connection to listeners?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I never really saw them as separate. Like, I think that I studied classics because I was sort of inherently interested in ancient Greek and Latin literature and philosophy. But, you know, one of my big interests has been, as I say, ancient Greek democracy. So, of course, ancient Greek democracy was very different to modern democracy, but it also has obvious sort of parallels and overlaps. So, you know, in studying ancient Greek democracy, I was always thinking about modern democracy as well, modern democratic theory, modern democratic practice. And that's what drew me into those political science courses. So to me, it doesn't seem that strange now to be working in a think tank because, you know, in some ways, the ancient Greek democratic ideals were very similar to ours. Okay, in some ways, they were very different. Right, they had slaves. They didn't let women take part in politics. But they also talked about things like equality of access to political institutions. They talked about freedom of speech. They had actually two separate terms for freedom of speech. They talked about majority rule. They had institutions for all of these things, you know, to guarantee equality and majority rule, at least among the male citizens. So these are all things you can also think about in modern New Zealand politics. You know, electoral systems are also, you know, we're trying to figure out how best to organize how best to kind of manifest some of these same values.
It echoes very well with me. I think there's nothing new under the sun. Says me, I don't have a doctorate or two masters, only one. But there's nothing new under the sun. We learn from the past of a foundation. But I'm taking us down a complete tangent, which, James, is very typical of me. So link us back to your report and popular opinions. You identified three issues in particular, and I wondered if we might just sort of this being a longer form interview, let's just tease out a little bit in each. And the first area you were saying within New Zealand academia and also being seen across the West is a greater leaning, almost a near exclusive, my phrase here, leaning into the left side of politics. Talk us through what you found and what are some examples of that?
Well, okay, so there's a huge skew towards the left in academia worldwide, or at least in English-speaking academia. We have a lot of good figures from the States and from the UK, not so much from Australia, actually, but also from Canada. So professors and students are overwhelmingly left-wing, and it, you know, the ratios in some of the humanities fields are really amazing. People might think it's sort of like three left-wingers for every right-winger. In some fields in the States where they do the breakdown by Democrats and Republicans, it's, 30 or 40 Democrats to every Republicans. There are a few fields, I think communications was one, where they looked in the study for the ratios of Republicans to Democrats, and they could not find any Republicans in that field. Is there among university professors? So that's the case across the English-speaking world. We don't have amazingly good figures for Australia or New Zealand, but in one of the recent free speech union surveys, they actually did a political breakdown of people who responded. And that, again, looks like there's a left-wing skew. That's not very representative, because obviously the people who answer the free speech union surveys are going to be, have certain interests. But we think that actually they're probably more right-wing, right? They're probably more centrist and right-wing if they're answering the free speech union surveys than the average New Zealand, the average sort of sample of New Zealand academics. And so, that's it's a hint that maybe something similar is the case in New Zealand universities. And that's been, just leaving data aside now, just sort of anecdotally, that's definitely my own experience. And I think that's the experience of most academics in New Zealand, even the ones who are on the left and maybe want to deny we have a problem on this front. I think they'll accept that, most of their friends are left-wing and, most of their colleagues are left-wing.
I suppose the question, look, I'm not an academic, but being around universities for long enough, that skew is real. Again, it's anecdotal, but it's real. I mean, how did we get here? I mean, is it we're left ideas better? And academics have said, gosh, right-wing ideas are stupid. Has it been a natural evolution that some might argue? I mean, how have we ended up with the skew that
possible.
We have?
It's possible. That some people say that reality has a left-wing bias, but there are actually studies which look, for example, if you take sort of the top 5% of people by IQ, then there isn't actually the left and right skew that we see in universities, so it's a bit more balanced. So, there are things like that which suggest that it's not the case that it's just all the smart people are left-wing. So how do we get here? I mean, if you look at the graphs for the UK, for UK academics and US academics, these ratios have increased over time. So if you go back to the 70s and 80s, they weren't as bad. There were still more left-wingers at universities when the sort of data series began in the 70s and 80s, but they weren't sort of vastly more. So I think that once you get a majority, some dynamics can start to sort of start up, which is that the right-wing people feel slightly less comfortable in that job. The left-wing people become slightly more self-confident. Maybe more left-wing people come, some right people retire, they stay away. Then you get, a bigger gap between left and right. Then the left-wing people become even more confident and the right-wing people start to feel even more like this isn't the place for them. And so over time, this effect ramps up. I think that that's probably a lot of it.
Do you think it would, I suppose this is a hypothetical, but would that dynamic happen in reverse? I mean, if ultimately a right-wing faculty got stronger and stronger, would they be actively pushing the left out as well? Is this just a very human dynamic that just happens to be?
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. It's a very human dynamic. And that's another reason to believe that it's not just that the sort of intellectual elite is always left-wing, because there are periods and places in history where the academy was very right-wing. So, I mean, a very strong example is obviously Hitler's Germany. I mean, there were lots of people like Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, who were sort of card-carrying Nazis. And even before that, I think the universities in Germany at the time were kind of quite establishment. And there have been other countries in which that, that's been the case. So, So now we have a left-wing intellectual elite. We have a left-wing academy.
Again, sort of playing devil's advocate, because I think reading your reports and thoughts align a lot with my own. I don't mean at the intellectual level, but the concepts resonate. But I mean, what is then the problem? I mean, if the left-wing academy is reflecting a more left-leaning society, I mean, what are the problems that you've identified in your report?
Well, that's actually, not to be pedantic, but that's actually a big if. It's not actually the case that the left-wing academy is reflecting a more left-wing society. I mean, society may well have become more left-wing over time in various ways, but the distribution of political opinions in the academy is actually very unlike the distribution of political opinions in the populace, even among the educated populace. So that's the problem.
I think it's good to draw that out as a response, because look, you even just need to look at basic polling in elections. I know it's not the best analogy, but actually there's quite a split of left-right in New Zealand as we know.
Yeah, that's right. And there are certain topics, for example, the Treaty of Waitangi or sex and gender, where you can actually poll people. And a lot of people say, I mean, there's a survey, I can't remember all the details, but quoted it in the report, where lots of people said that they disagreed with gender ideology. Now, disagreeing with gender ideology, as we document in the report, that's something that will actually get you into a heck of a lot of trouble at universities at the moment, right? So the universities have kind of built this bubble where certain views kind of take hold and certain views hold sway in a way that is actually very unusual for the rest of society. So it's really strange. Like, we set up these institutions so that people can discuss things and have freedom of speech and freedom of investigation. And in some ways, they're actually less free than the rest of society in terms of what you can talk about.
Well, I've noticed it. I'm going to pick on one university. It's my alma mater. Is Auckland Uni has a new code of conduct now. Not so much in the gender space per se, although lots of discussion about, you know, keeping people safe and no real harmful discussion. But right at the start, they talk about the other controversial topic, which is the treaty. And they make, I would argue, James, a dogmatic statement about it. And I'm not quite sure how they can reconcile it, effectively a dogmatic statement on a controversial topic, while also having the academic freedom. And I think one of the things your report drew out was that academics feel they can't talk about that either.
That's right. And this brings us into the whole problem of institutional neutrality. So the practice of institutions, universities, but also scholarly societies like the Royal Society, basically putting out an official view on a certain topic. Now, I mean, the Royal Society, for example, when it was just science, when it was just dedicated to science as opposed to the sciences and the humanities, or even now, you might think that it's within its remit to defend science, for example. But, you know, arguably that's kind of uncontroversial that a scientific institution is going to defend science. What's more controversial is, you know, what a scientific institution is going to say about Maturanga Māori, whether Māori traditional lore is the same as science or not. Because we know that academics actually disagree about that. Not only academics, but also members of the broad public. So that's the problem. It's that universities are actually taking official positions on very controversial position, controversial issues, even though they know that some of their own faculty disagree with it. So you might have heard recently that the Auckland Faculty of Education were having a restructure, and they put out the criteria for being a lecturer. And I think one of them was actually something along the lines of engaging with Maturanga Māori. And they must have known that, for example, Professor Elizabeth Ratza has very skeptical ideas about Maturanga Māori. You know, she respects it in some ways, but thinks it's not science. So I think that sort of thing is wholly inappropriate. The universities are supposed to be neutral with regard to the kinds of conversations that their academics are having and the big issues in society as a whole.
I'm probably going to articulate this badly, so feel free to criticize or finagle it, for want of a better word. But in my mind, universities, in a way, as an entity, barely exists. University doesn't exist. It's an umbrella, if you will, a protector for a whole lot of individual academics. A little bit of what you're saying, they've all got their different views and perspectives, and they come together into a university. But we seem to have now, it's as if the university is a corporate entity in and of itself, independent of the faculty, of the academics. And it's making a series of statements and rules and regulations, and making statements, like you just said, on behalf of a faculty. And you go, how can that be possible? The university doesn't exist other than it is there for the academics. It's not a separate administrative corporate structure. Or have I missed the boat?
No, I agree with that. I think a lot of academics would agree with that. I mean, but it's become more of a corporate structure over time. It's sort of ceased to see itself as a community of scholars, which is, I think, the real ideal. I mean, the word university ultimately comes from, well, universitas, which, you know, at its root, the adjective universus means universal. But actually, there was a phase in the Middle Ages when that word actually referred to like a society, an association of people. So the university is actually an association of people who are interested in knowledge. And we've moved quite a long way from that ideal. But this might get us into another thing we talked about in the report, which is the way that the university nowadays, by thinking of itself as a corporation, and by being focused on things like its brand, has actually, you know, undermined academic freedom, undermined freedom of thought, because it's constantly having to manage what it perceives as risks, you know, risks to its reputation, risks to the bottom line, really, because it's thinking, you know, if something controversial happens and we're in the paper, does that mean that student numbers are going to be lower next year? We actually say in the report that we doubt these assumptions. We think that if universities have a reputation for internal dissent and openness and you know, respectful disagreement, that's actually a good thing. People will actually respect that. And they'll probably respect that more than if they hear stories or the reports come out documenting the ways in which universities have actually clamped down on dissent and free speech and open discussion of ideas.
Look, I'd completely agree. And if I might, I'd say it's analogous actually in politics. Through my experience, political parties are becoming quite, if you will, corporate and singular, and there isn't actually the breadth of debate. In fact, if MPs in a particular party, doesn't matter if it's left or right, go off piste, start having slightly divergent opinions, that's got to be clamped down very, very swiftly. And I would argue it's one of the reasons, again, I can't easily prove it, but I'd say it's one of the reasons political parties in general struggle to get wider support, because people go, oh, I'm not seeing that breadth of expression. But I know in your report that I think you talk about bloated administration. That's an early report. It's echoed again in this most recent one. So you're saying you've got your faculty, your lecturers, your academics, your professors, but there's all these administrators now, and you think that is, my term here, but throttling the free speech and opinions of the unis.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's all administrators. I mean, what we looked at in the report was actually non-academic workers, which is slightly different. So, but they're not academics, and they're anything from librarians to managers. A lot of those people are just doing good jobs, and they're doing jobs that need to be done, although in greater numbers than they were in the past. But there is also a small number of people who are involved in, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion type areas, or disability services, or that kind of thing. And when I was at Victoria University, I mean, there were these posters, there was sort of official posters from the university that were put up. And they were saying things like, Victoria University has no tolerance for gender inequality, or, you know, other things like that. They were on race, on gender, on all these hot topic issues. And, you know, sometimes they would sound good. There's no tolerance for racism. Of course, I agree with that. You know, we shouldn't have racism. But you just sort of got the idea that these people had some quite radical ideas about race and about sexuality, the kinds of ideas that have become orthodoxy on the university. So then my question was always, well, look, at the time I was a lecturer, then senior lecturer in classics, what power do these people have over me? And I don't really know what the answer to that was. But, you know, there were a few incidents that happened when I was at university, or either to me or that I heard of, where, you know, students would complain about something you'd said in class, a word you'd used. And my own personal experience was that the university very much did not have your back in these situations. Very much did not have your back. In fact, there were a certain number of people working for the university whose job seemed to be to kind of get you into more trouble for these things and to investigate these things. And there wasn't anyone on staff whose job was to protect you, academics against this kind of thing, even though there's a legislated right in the Education Act for academics to actually talk about unpopular and controversial opinions.
Funny, I saw those same posters when I was moving my stepdaughter into the halls, and I think I may have said it out loud and got a few looks from, which is probably not the best thing for a stepfather to be doing to it. But it was like, well, if we can't discuss these topics, then why are we here? It just seems so very limiting. And the other observation is, it seems to me a lot of what academics are and are not allowed to speak about is sort of curated now. I notice what does get published in the papers seems to have been approved, is my impression of things. And when I think of the scope of the faculty and views, I don't see them. So I think, does your report talk about, if you will, a curation of ideas of what does come to the public? Because the university administration or corporate nature, again, limits or controls that?
I don't think there's anything in the report that that is evidence for that. I don't think personally that that's going on directly. I don't think that administrators are saying you can't put out this article directly, but I think that various academics who put in anonymous testimonies raise several issues. I mean, one of them was getting funding. So there's definitely a perception among academics in New Zealand, many academics in New Zealand, that if you don't toe the line on some of these more ideological questions, it's going to be more difficult for you to get funding. I actually thought about this. I mean, we might go on and talk about Western civilization later, but I actually had a project on Western civilization, which is, by the way, very moderate. It was just trying to argue that Western civilization actually existed and it could be defended as a sort of concept. And I thought about whether I would put it in for a type of grant. And I thought, best not do that. It'd probably be a waste of time. And then I thought later, or maybe I was too cynical. And then I heard rumors through people who were sitting in on some of the selection meetings that someone said, oh, there's a person on that committee who's dead set against anything that identifies as Western. I don't know if it's true. These are all rumors. But definitely, I'm not alone in having a perception that, yeah, if you're working on anything that's, you know, identifiable as even kind of center-right or centrist, then you might be in trouble. It's not true across the board. I always try and emphasize that universities are big places, and there's lots and lots of work being done on things which, even in the current febrile atmosphere, it's very hard to put a political spin on. So there are all these people working on, you know, cures for cancer and material science and pure mathematics and things like that. And there's probably no problem with those things. But definitely there's a perception among many academics that unless you toe the line ideologically, your career is going to be in difficulty and you're going to find it more difficult to get things funded and get things published.
Yeah, and that's part of that cancel culture, which we're all familiar with. And I know your report touches on it. It's something we're very familiar with, so I suppose we don't have to go into it too much in depth. Is that people, yeah, getting cancelled, certain discussions can't be had, academics, guest speakers are hounded out. It's something we're very, very familiar with setting. And I might just add too, for the sake of listeners, we are always talking in the general sense. As James says, there's lots of amazing people doing amazing work, but there are these general trends in play, which is quite concerning. And I'd see recently AUT universities in trouble because they did a survey, and actually talking to Jonathan Ayling of the Free Speech Union about it recently, that, you know, they do a survey on bullying and or the culture of the law faculty. The results come back saying it's not pretty, not good. When they get leaked because no one did anything, all hell breaks loose, but not about changing the culture, but trying to identify who dared to question them.
Yeah,
very unhealthy.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, there was another survey that came out last year internally from Auckland where they asked people, do you feel able to respectfully voice your opinion or disagreement without fear of unreasonable consequences or something like that? So it was explicitly saying, like, imagine, you know, you're not just ranting or anything, you're being very respectful. Do you think, and you think you can do that and disagree in that way without there being consequences of your career? And only 15% of academics in the law school agreed with that. And that was a low figure. I mean, in other programs, it varied between, I think, 30% and something like 50%. I think the median in the science faculty was 36% or something like that. But that's very worrying. I mean, you should, ideally in a university, you'd have all or most of academics saying, of course I can voice disagreement in a respectful way without thinking that there's going to be consequences for my career, right? I mean, we're meant to be living in a free country and liberal democracy, right?
I think the word
should
meant
be the case that academics can disagree respectfully without there being consequences for their career.
Well, but sadly, there are, and it's, I don't know how to quite phrase this correctly. I'm thinking of it. Her name's Dr. or Professor now, Joanna Howe. She's an Australian, and granted, in her case, law professor, but gets into the pro-life issues. Long and short, she's been vexatiously hounded for having those views and doing her research. She's been hauled before tribunals and councils, and eventually had to go to the Fair Work Commission over there to have it all stop. But why I mention it is she's doing a respectful bit of research into a controversial area, admittedly, but just the mere process of defending herself has been exhausting. And yeah. I wonder, do we have similar dynamics here at play that probably are just keeping professors and academics quiet? They go, I just don't want to end up being hauled in front of the dean or the HR department.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. We had a few cases in the documented in the report where the people have sort of several meetings with the dean or the head of school. One other thing I'd mention is that when we were doing research for the report, several times people would give us a sort of tip off and say, oh, this thing, you know, I heard this thing happen, or even I observed this thing happening. So one person said, this guy at University X criticized the vice chancellor. And then, you know, a few years later, he was gone. He fell in a sort of package of cuts. And, you know, we actually talked to several people, all of whom thought that the reason that this guy was gone was because he criticized the vice chancellor. Then, of course, you know, we write to this person and say, can you talk about it? No answer. So that was a very common experience. I had that several times. And then some people would actually write back and say, I'm unable to talk about this either because of ongoing legal proceedings or because of non-disclosure agreements. So these are apparently quite common in universities, you know, after people leave. So they get pushed out or they agree to leave. And then the university says, basically, don't tell anybody anything. There's usually like a non-denigration clause. You're not allowed to say anything negative about the university. And those are apparently common. And like when I talk to people in the university about them, sometimes the reaction I get is that I'm being naive. You know, people are sort of like, oh, don't you realize that everyone signs a non-disclosure agreement? And I just think, but there shouldn't be so many, at least, non-disclosure agreements, because these are public institutions. They're spending taxpayer money. We have a right to know what's going on with these institutions. And I just don't understand why universities would need them. Like, what are they doing that they need to keep secret, right?
Yeah. Well, I think, too, it's part of that architecture which continues to limit freedom. So it doesn't matter if it's non-disclosure. I would argue some of these processes they put in place around, I would argue most of the time vexatious litigants, but also, as I mentioned earlier, codes of conduct, a whole lot of things in play which are just slowly limiting that freedom, as you rightly point out, of a public institution. Before we jump, because I really do want to get into this Western civilization side of things, listeners won't be able to see my face, but I'm smiling with sort of eager anticipation. But your report recently also touched on interference from the CCP, or the Chinese Communist Party, which is one of my hot topics, as listeners know, having been, well, I don't know, it's not quite unique, but specifically targeted by the Chinese Communist Party. I don't know if that's a little badge of honor to keep on my wall, but how are they interfering with our universities? Just illustrate that for people. I'm aware of it, but maybe just for them to understand.
Okay, so I mean, this really pertains to a kind of cluster of episodes that are documented in our report between around 2018 and 2020. So the big one, I mean, the big sort of figure involved in this is Anne-Marie Brady, who's a professor at Christchurch at Canterbury. And her house was burgled. She had some, I think, disks or USB drives tampered with. It's all documented in the report. And she alleges that this was, you know, Communist Party agents. She may well be right. I think she probably is right. If anyone saw the recent Stuff documentary, The Long Game, you know, it seems very clear that the Chinese Communist Party is interested in New Zealand, interested in interfering in New Zealand. So there's no reason why they wouldn't try and go after academics as well. Emery Brady also wrote a report about links between Chinese universities and New Zealand universities. Victoria University of Wellington and University of Auckland then made formal complaints about this report, in which they were named, and you know they had their own links to Chinese universities traced in that report. University of Canterbury then reviewed that report, or you know, investigated effectively Emery Brady, which was, I would say, an extremely unusual thing to do. Academics, not only in New Zealand, but across the world, wrote an open letter against that. Besides that, there was, I think, one episode in our report about student protests around 2019, when, as people may remember, Hong Kong was under the kibosh from the mainland Chinese state. They were using various, you know, legislative tools and also the police to kind of clamp down on free speech in Hong Kong. There was a sort of wave of student protests across the world, often led by Hong Kong Chinese students. And that was the same in New Zealand. There was a student here, Serena Lee, who was putting up posters, and she got confronted by a few Chinese men. There's actually a video of this episode. And they sort of angrily denounce her, really, and say, Hong Kong is part of China. They're denouncing her in English and Chinese. And one of them kind of confronts her physically. She falls over and sort of ends up on the ground. That's actually kind of like a small, like a microcosm of the protests that we saw around the same time in Australia, where sort of very similar things were happening with a bit more violence. We're not like vast amounts of violence. Of course, there were vast amounts of violence in Hong Kong by the Chinese state, but, you know, fisticuffs and things like that. So that's obviously a little bit concerning. You know, there's some suspicion about who these pro mainland Chinese state students are. Are they kind of just normal students who are really riled up and nationalistic, or are they being planted? I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that question. But so, yeah. So there is some evidence that, you know, the Chinese are involved. I don't know why all the episodes cluster around that period, 2018 to 2020. I suspect that, like New Zealand and other countries, we've wisened up a bit about how we think about the Chinese state. I think for a long time, there was a lot of naivety. Of course, like, we need to engage with China. China's a very important country. There's a lot of intelligent people in China, a lot of good scholars. It's natural that academics want to collaborate with them. But we really need to be a little bit careful, because fundamentally, it is, you know, the world's largest autocracy. It's a communist autocracy. The state that runs China is the direct heir to the same organization that was involved in, you know, the Great Leap Forward and the Great Famine and, you know, millions of deaths. So we really just need to be a little bit cautious about how we're collaborating with them.
Well, you're preaching to the converted here, but it's one of the reasons why it's good you elaborate. I think people need to be aware of this. And look, I'll say with my hat on and the work I've done, I mean, look, Anne-Marie Brady, myself and Louisa Wall were specifically targeted recently by CCP to access our systems. It's not unusual. I certainly know in the academic world, talking to others, people that, you know, there are people in their classes, if they're on a sensitive topic to the Communist Party, recording, photographing, not just the lecturer, but who's there. And it's all those, I'll phrase it this way, James, the low-level intimidation. I mean, if you are someone who wants to ask a question and you know there's someone from the, you know, Loyal Chinese Students Association, yeah, you're not going to do it. Yeah. You're not going to do it.
I did actually hear a story from a lecturer who said that she was teaching and, there was a Chinese student who afterwards kind of approached her and sort of argued very strenuously against some of the things she was saying. The problem is with some of these things, I would ask, people would talk to me kind of off the record, and then I would say again, oh, would you like to, can I put this in my report? And there wasn't any sort of hard evidence I could cite, so I left it out. But yeah, I've heard stories like that myself. Yeah.
I found it in the political realm, even when I chaired foreign affairs, actually amazing people would get in contact, and some fascinating story, horrifying stories too. But when you said to them, would you go public? Can I use this?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it's like, damn it. Well, yeah. let's contrast, let's jump, because you know, you've just talked about, you know, an autocratic communist regime which has a history and a heritage. Let's talk about Western civilization. You talked briefly on it earlier, and you said, does it exist? So let's start with that question. We talk about Western civilization. I'm looking at books on my bookshelf. Does it exist?
Yes, is there a Western civilization? At least, if you want to be very cautious about it, it existed as a fact of global cultural history. There was a tradition of painting and art, and also a sort of sociological tradition, a way of doing things, which we can identify as Western, and which we can identify on several dimensions as distinct from what was going on in the rest of the world, in sort of hunter-gatherer societies, in other great civilizations like China and Persia and, you know, Islamic civilization and the great sort of American civilizations, pre-modern American civilizations, pre-contact American civilizations. So yeah, this is one of the things I got in trouble with while I was still in trouble about when I was still in academia, because it seems like in my field, my ex-field, classics, there are a lot of people who are arguing that it's just a narrative. It's just one of these meta narratives that we want to sort of tell about ourselves. And they say, you know, Western civilization doesn't really exist because it's very complicated. And there are lots of countries that we're not really sure whether they're in the West or not, like Russia. And it sort of has these fuzzy boundaries, and it's very, you know, it's very multifaceted. So is it really a thing? And I just think these are terrible arguments because, of course, there are lots of things in life. Think about art or music. You know, it's kind of has fuzzy boundaries. There are lots of works of art that people will disagree about whether they're really art. The category art includes lots of different things, right? So it's multifaceted. But nonetheless, it would be insane to say that art doesn't really exist. And it's the same thing with Western civilization. It actually is very helpful as a concept. It's very useful. And I think it's interesting that a lot of the critics of Western civilization, people who are trying to tell us it doesn't exist, they're often forced to refer to it. So they will refer to the West or Western civilization, and they'll put these scare quotes around it. But I always sort of think, well, yeah, you're using it because it's a very useful concept, because it actually refers to something very distinct in global cultural history.
Well, I was going to say, that was sort of my first response, is that for those people who deny it exists or existed, they seem to be the same ones to me spending all their time attacking it. So it
exactly. Seems a bit- so this is a strange thing. You know, they want to assert both that Western civilization doesn't exist and never existed, and also it's responsible for most of the world's ills. Right? You've got to choose one of these things.
Yeah, exactly right. You can't say it's part of the world's ills if you don't think it really existed. I mean, we have to speak in generalities here, but do those who oppose the idea, again, oppose the idea of a Western civilization, do they believe in other civilizations?
Well, that's another problem. I think that that's a very fascinating thing. Like, all of this sort of deconstructive energy and the critique and the sharp skepticism is turned on Western civilization, but it doesn't seem to be turned on Chinese civilization or Islamic civilization. I mean, I suppose the more consistent ones would argue that these are all just narratives, but I think to most ordinary people, it just seems, you know, more commonsensical to say there were several, you know, clusters of practices. There were several great civilizations in world history, and the West was one of them. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated in the sense that, you know, there is an overlap. There are interesting overlaps between especially kind of Western civilization and Islamic civilization. So especially there were Arabic commentators on Aristotle. So some of the most important Greek texts were studied by Muslim philosophers. But I think academics want to focus on those edge cases and say that they're typical. I think that they're extremely interesting, but they're extremely interesting because they're untypical. So most of the people who commented on Greek texts in human history were actually scholars in the West, you know, scholars in, well, Byzantium, either, you know, what some Westerners would call the East, but it's effectively the West, or in sort of Western Europe. So Aquinas and people like that were commenting on Aristotle as well. And that is really the mainstream tradition. And more Greek texts actually got transmitted through Byzantium and through Western monasteries than through the Muslim world. But academics nowadays, I think, want to just obsess about these cases. Another classic example is the Silk Roads, you know, this idea that the great civilizations of the West and China were always connected. And again, that's extremely fascinating. There were sort of Greco-Bactrian kingdoms between Alexander's empire and the Mauryan empire, what became the Mauryan empire in India. There were Greek texts, you know, Buddhist texts written in Greek by Greek philosophers. All that, again, is extremely fascinating, but it doesn't, you know, it shouldn't prevent us from seeing the fact that, you know, the mainline tradition of Indian philosophy and of, you know, what became Hinduism and Buddhism is mostly separate from the main tradition of Western philosophy. And that I think is just sort of obvious to anybody who takes a step back from these cultural debates and just looks at the way global cultural history turned out. I mean, otherwise, it would be almost strange that Aquinas, you know, someone like Thomas Aquinas, he only really quotes, he engages with some Muslim philosophers, but mainly he's only quoting Aristotle and the Bible. So why isn't he quoting Confucius? Why isn't he quoting Lao Tzu? I think in this new way of looking at global cultural history, it's almost as if people expect Aquinas to be quoting Shang Yang. You know, they think it's equally probable that he would be doing that. But in fact, it isn't equally probable, because we know that there were these traditions that grew up over time. People were hindered by, you know, technological constraints in the time they were living. And that's why we get these great traditions. In some ways, these great traditions are kind of a gift of the fact that people for hundreds of years didn't have the internet. They were, you know, constrained to look at what they knew about. In the West, they knew about Greek and Latin philosophy. They didn't really know about Chinese philosophy. In China, obviously, they had their own rich traditions, but they didn't really know about the tradition in the West.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating, amongst other things, as someone who does believe in the concepts of civilizations, that actually there are, well, they've generated their own stories, myths, philosophies, understandings, religions, et cetera, et cetera, is sometimes where there is the crossover. And what I mean there is not that it's being drawn from those other cultures, but how separate civilization, both in time and space, have actually often come up with very similar ideas, not the same, but there's often a similarity as well as lots of differences. But I'm also struck, James, you talked about my theology background is Thomistic. So yeah, Thomas Aquinas, the Summa Theologica, all very familiar to me, and you're quite right of where he draws his influences. But one of the early myths that got debunked was that Western society, post-Rome, collapsed, all the knowledge ended up in Arabia, and it's only when we turned up in the Crusades that we stole it all back sort of concept. It's like, what the?
Yeah.
It's just a mad myth that lingers. So I mean,
that's a good example of what I mean. I think that it is true that some texts were studied by people like Averroes and Avicenna in Muslim countries, and they made a genuine contribution, and they were genuinely interesting thinkers. It's just that that's not actually the main story. Like, I think that we're interested in that precisely because those things are unusual, and I think academics have been sort of waylaid by that, because academics kind of know all this stuff anyway. Like, I think nowadays, if you're studying as a, you know, graduate student in intellectual history, it would seem kind of boring to do your dissertation on Aquinas, on Aristotle's influence on Aquinas, because it's sort of already known, right? So you want to work on Avicenna or something even more kind of abstruse. But then I think you have all these people working on these edge cases, and they come to think that the edge case is the whole of the reality, whereas actually the reality is much more sort of mundane, if you want to put it like that, that, you know, these traditions that we kind of grew up reading about, we grew up reading about them for a reason, because actually that's the kind of main streams of global cultural influence.
Sort of a final question, but well, probably, never know, we might go off on other tangents, but why is it, let's take Western civilization exists, and I think it does, and B, even its opponents by attacking it illustrate that it does. Why is there such a, I'm going to say hatred, it's probably a better word I could use, but there seems to be a disdain in some sectors, and I see it in New Zealand and across a lot of Western society at the moment, a disdain for Western culture. Everything else, yeah, great, amazing, holy, pure. Western civilization, terrible. I mean, how on A, is it accurate? And B, on how on earth have we got here like a Leviathan eating ourselves?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. I think this is actually one of the big issues that sort of underlies a lot of the culture wars. And I don't really know how to explain it. I mean, I think it's partly these effects, like academics want to be seen to be saying something sophisticated and clever and maybe a little bit daring. And I think that for a long time, it was actually genuinely daring to criticize the West and sort of criticize ourselves. Like, that's very much a virtue that gets cultivated in intellectual circles, and that's for good reason, like the ability to criticize your own society, because that is actually unusual historically. But we've kind of gone overboard with that tendency. There's a book out, actually, I can't remember the name of the author now, but it's called Oikophobia. This is, I think, his own coinage for this idea of sort of, well, it literally means the fear of your own home. But this idea that Westerners are distinctively kind of self-hating in terms of their own culture. But yeah, I think it's something that comes out of the intelligentsia. It's something that comes out of universities. And it's very difficult to understand, especially because if you look at a lot of the data, a lot of the evidence, from a left-wing perspective especially, Western civilization has been enormously successful. You know, you have some of the longest-lived, healthiest, in many cases, the most equal populations economically in world history. The poor are thriving. The poor in developed countries and Western countries for a long time were much wealthier than the poor anywhere else in the world. And also in terms of things like the relationships between the two sexes. I mean, women were obviously a lot freer and more equal in the West than in the Islamic world, and still now, and you know, the effect was even stronger in the past. So to me, it just seems very hard to understand. I mean, I think in New Zealand and Canada and countries like that, where there's an indigenous population, there's also this guilt about, you know, genuine harms, genuine injustices, which were practiced against the indigenous people. But I think this has also gone overboard. Now, it's almost as if the indigenous people are sort of playing out this woke dream, you know, that everything that people on the progressive left like is retrojected onto the indigenous past. Whereas actually, if you look at some of the evidence, it seems like indigenous people were kind of like people all over the world before fairly recently. They were, you know, they were engaged in lots of violent warfare. It's not their fault. It's not because they were unique in this or unusual. It's actually sort of the way of the world everywhere. I just think we have to sort of accept at some point that there is such a thing as progress. Maybe it's multifaceted. Maybe there are different ways of doing it. But yeah, I think that all over the world, you know, populations, countries have moved away from the old ways of doing things, which involved a lot more violence and you know, we're a lot less controlled, a lot less democratic, a lot less liberal. And some of them we just need to sort of leave behind.
You've actually highlighted a dynamic in my mind that I hadn't considered before, that, and it could be wrong in this, but as some scholars, academics, politicos, whatever, activists decry Western civilization, they also, if you will, falsely inflate others. So as they go, Western civilization bad, they mythologize and romanticize other cultures. And it's like, well, no, that didn't happen in that way. As you were saying, there's some elements around the colonial versus the indigenous.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting thing. I mean, one thing that just occurs to me, one aspect of that that just occurs to me now for whatever reason, is this discourse about slavery. So it is true that, of course, the Atlantic slave trade was large and completely abhorrent. But it's also true that the British Empire was responsible for the ending of the slave trade. I mean, it was very out of step with mores in the rest of the world among the other great powers at the time, when the British started trying to first stamp out slavery within their own realm and then sort of fight it more generally and encourage others to drop it. And that's something which is sort of routinely forgotten about. It's almost another one of these things at universities that you can't even mention. So it's weird. We sort of go on about the British as people who sort of defused slavery and took part in slavery for so many years, and they did. But it's like we're forgetting the most salient, the most obvious, the most important fact, which is that the British were actually the ones who turned against it decisively at a time when nobody else was doing it. And, you know, this... someone who studies the ancient world, I mean, there was, of course, you know, millions of slaves in the ancient world. There were slaves in other civilizations. There were slaves in Islam. I mean, Muslim states for a long time were kind of well known for their military slaves, Mamluks. So there are all sorts of sort of interesting slave cultures all over the world. And it's one of those things, again, if you actually have a broad view of history, it's really the norm among at least, you know, well-developed civilizations to have slaves. I'm not saying that justifies it. I don't think it does at all. But it's a strange sort of one-eyed view of history to look back and sort of blame it all on the West.
Oh, it does my head in, I'll be honest. It does my head in. I mean, I'm not as well-trained as you, but know enough about history and philosophy and so forth to go, there's a general state of humanity, and we, particularly in the West, are pulling ourselves out of that. The fact that we have a lot of equalities, that our economy is doing better than most has in history, that we have things like free speech. I mean, that's a relatively new concept. Actually, no, I better back up on that. You'd mentioned that the Greeks had it.
I mean, but maybe one final thing I can get in just at the end here, because I wrote a long Substack post on this. People can check out my Owl of Athena Substack if they're really interested in a 45-minute long. Apparently, it takes 45 minutes to read it. I didn't realize that when I wrote it. But basically, this is the kind of summary of this new theory of the West that I encountered in a book by Joseph Henrich. It's called The Weirdest People in the World. Yeah, Joseph Henrich, I think he's an anthropologist at Harvard. And the weird in the title is this acronym for, I think it's Western Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic Countries. And the basic premise is that psychologists have assumed for too long that when they do studies with Western students, that these can then be generalized to the rest of the world. And they're now figuring out that actually Western people are different in various ways. So the book kind of starts from the present. And then he tries to explain, like, well, why are we different? And what ways are we different and why are we different? And one thing he talks about a lot is that Westerners' sort of family structure is actually very distinctive. So this idea that, you know, it's a nuclear family. Also, you know, you're not allowed to marry certain people. You're not allowed to marry your in-laws after if your brother dies, you're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. You're not allowed to marry cousins. That all these things seem very normal to us, but they're actually quite rare in the rest of the world. And so Henrich suggests that this was actually something that was pushed by the Western Church, the Catholic Church, and then to some extent by Protestantism as well, less so by Eastern Orthodoxy, but to some extent by them as well. And he thinks that what this did is basically made it very difficult in the West to maintain large sort of kinship structures. Because if you want to maintain these large kinship networks, it's very useful to be able to kind of marry your cousin and have a lot of leeway about who you get hitched with. And he thinks that by restraining this, what the church effectively did is give a fillip or sort of incentivize collaboration between non-kin. And so that's one of the things that the West became distinctive about the West. You suddenly get this burgeoning of all these kind of non-kin cooperative institutions, guilds, and also things like universities. And as that ramps up, it does have some effect, it seems, on the way people think about the world. They become more individualistic. They become more aligned to sort of abstract rules of morality rather than to kind of helping their kin. And so he actually has like a big theory of the West where even things like science and liberalism and democracy come out of this mindset that's generated by these changes to family structure that are ultimately created by the Catholic Church. Now, I actually think the only thing I might be able to add to this, I think, is that I think that some of these processes were also identifiable in ancient Greece. And of course, they didn't have the Christian church, where I think you also get this similar concern to kind of like tamp down kinship networks and really encourage people to collaborate with one another within the city state. So you have this sort of city state ideology where they're doing some of the same things. They don't get quite to the same results, but I think they were sort of on the path to that before the ancient world came down in flames with the end of the Roman Empire. But anyway, so that's that's like the big new theory of the West and sort of what made it distinctive. And I wrote the post partly because it's just such a shame. It seems to me to be such a shame, so sort of disappointing and sad that so many prominent classicists now have jumped on this bandwagon of the Western, you know, Western civilization didn't exist. And, you know, if it did, it was evil and it was all a narrative. When all of these quite empirically minded scholars in sort of economic history and sociology and anthropology are actually doing really good, you know, work that's grounded in data and grounded in evidence. And they're all kind of converging on this new explanation of what made the West distinct. And it helps us understand history, helps us understand ourselves. And it's not even that, you know, it's not completely self-aggrandizing because there are aspects of it which are kind of negative. I mean, one thing I didn't know about before I read Henrich's book was that there's actually considerable evidence that Protestantism in history, it seems to boost literacy, but it also seems to boost suicide rates, right? So there's something about the Christian sort of guilt complex that can also have negative effects on psychology. But the point isn't to sort of self-aggrandize. The point is to understand the global cultural past and to understand ourselves in the West as well. So I think it's a shame if people sort of just turn against this and won't even engage with it, because I think it's very much worth looking into.
Well, sadly, at times, I think, James, people are the old adage of pulling up the ladder, you know, so a lot of the people who are knocking down the West, for example, have benefited from it. They're now in wonderful academic positions and have a freedom to speak, and they can publish books and so on and so forth. And like, but oh no, no, it's all bad. We'll pull up the ladder. I mean, it's just annoying. I'd also add, not that I've read that book, I need to, and your Substack, but once we move away from kin relationships, you actually move away from some of the inherent problems within tribalism as well. I mean, we are still seeing that in areas of the Middle East where big tribal groupings violently fight against one another. Old histories are held very deeply and personally. So perhaps a discussion for another day. But just remind listeners, where can we find your Substack?
Oh, it's called Owl of Athena. So I think you just Google like James Kirstead, Owl of Athena, and it should come up.
James, this has been a fascinating, well, it has been for me, and I'm hoping it's the listeners as well. I just really and quite truly enjoy these sort of conversations. So look, thank you for not only the generosity of your time, but also for the work you're leading. And I look forward to perhaps chatting with you again if you are open to that.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
So everyone, that was Dr. James Kirstead. He's the Senior Research Fellow at the New Zealand Institute Initiative, not the New Zealand, the New Zealand Initiative.
It's okay. In the past, there was an organizational institute that flowed into us. So it's, initiative now.
Hey, thanks so much.
All right, cheers.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.